the story of Abraham at Gerar and his rather strange encounter with the heathen king Abimelech. And I think there are one or two important lessons for us as Christians to be learned from this important chapter before we really come to the heart of its message. And the first thing that we should notice is this. If you've been following carefully our studies in the book of Genesis, you cannot have failed to notice that this is not the first time that Abraham has journeyed towards the south and landed in trouble. In fact, we have read a story rather like this story before in the book of Genesis. Nor is this the first time that he and Sarah have got themselves into trouble because of their clever lies. Abraham pretending that she was a sister, and Sarah pretending, because she was inveigled in it as well, pretending that he was her brother. And it is not the first time that Abraham has been shamed by finding more righteousness in a pagan king than there was in himself. Because a story almost parallel to this is found in Genesis chapter 12. You remember that Abraham had shot right through the promised land, almost missing his destiny, past Shechem, past Bethel, past Jerusalem, down to the magnetic south of Egypt. And in Egypt, he did exactly what he did in this chapter. He pretended that Sarah was his sister, that they were just brother and sister, and so he discovered that there was more righteousness in the heathen Pharaoh of Egypt than there was in himself. If you care to turn back to Genesis chapter 12, you will see how close the parallel is. We read from verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And Egypt in the Old Testament is always used symbolically of the old life. We are redeemed from Egypt. We are redeemed from an old way of life. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful to behold, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say, you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared on your account. When Abraham entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And when the princes of Egypt, princes of Pharaoh, saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house, into the harem. And for her sake he dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep, oxen, he-asses, men-servants, maid-servants, she-asses, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues, because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And so Pharaoh called Abraham and said, what is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? More religion in a heathen king. Why did you say, she is my sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and be gone. And Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they set him on the way with his wife and all that he had. Now you see, you might have expected Abraham to learn from that incident that God does not need lies in order to further his kingdom on earth. God does not need lies and liars, because the Bible tells us that the God of the Bible is the God of truth. Truth is a passion with God. It is something that consumes him. He is the true and the living God. And because God is the God of truth, it is better to stand for the truth, whatever it costs you, than to live outside the world of truth. Because to live outside the world of truth is to live an unsafe life. It is very risky living in a world of lies and untruths. Now you would think, you see, that Abraham would have learned his lesson. But here in chapter 20, he repeats the whole episode again. And it seems as if Abraham in the land of Gerar has learned absolutely nothing. Now here is a very important lesson for Christians. I want you to see that this disaster came upon Abraham after a mountain peak of spiritual experience, after an exalted spiritual experience. And it seems to me that there is a kind of parallel here and a kind of pattern here in the Bibles, in the Bible. This is one of the reasons for my suspecting special experiences. And whenever I have a special experience of God and of Christ and of their love for me and their grace and their goodness to me, and whenever I'm lifted up in a spiritual ecstasy, the first thing I do is put up my defenses. Because there is a pattern in the Bible, and it seems as if mountain peak experiences are sometimes a prelude to disaster in the valley. You remember how Abraham had gone out from Ur of the Chaldees, and he had gone out in obedience to a God he could not see. Abraham obeyed God, an invisible God. He trusted this invisible God, and he went out not knowing whither he went. And it was after that that he journeyed towards the magnetic south and landed in Egypt. It was after this mountain peak experience of the obedience of faith that he journeyed towards the south. You see, the mountain peak ought to have put him on his guard and kept him on his toes. But instead, he lowered his defenses and he journeyed towards the south. And it's exactly the same here in chapter 20. The prelude to this fiasco in Gerar with the heathen king was the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham had dared to intercede with the living God for the life of the cities. And starting at 50, nobody had ever done this before. Starting at 50, he began to bargain with God. If there are 50, will you spare the cities? If there are 40, will you spare the cities? If there are 30, will you spare the cities? Down in multiples of 10 and 5, interceding with God. And it was after that mountain peak experience that he journeyed towards the south. Now you see, Christians, mountain peak experiences are very wonderful, and I think God knows that we need them, because we need to be lifted up. And we need encouragement for our hearts. But you can't live on a mountain all your life. It's very cold and very lonely on the top of a mountain. And if the mountain's high enough, it's very difficult to breathe. You can't live up there all your life. You see, God never intended us to live away up there all your life. I cannot endure these Christians who say, since I came to Jesus, I've always been up there. That's not real. It's not true to life. People who speak like that are living in a world of fantasy. They also haven't read their New Testaments. You can't live up there all the time. Because there are valleys. And when we are enjoying the ecstasies of God's being and God's person, and God's grace, and God's love, and God's care for us, we should always make sure that our defenses are up, because you never know what's going to happen. After trusting God in Ar, down to the south. After Sodom and Gomorrah, down to the south. After the ecstasy, the fiasco. And I'm sure it's not for nothing that the Apostle Paul, in Ephesians chapter 6, uses the word stand 4 times. Stand, stand, stand. As if that was one of the most important lessons any Christian could learn. With your back to the wall, stand, stand, stand. Never take your armor off. Stand, stand, stand. When did Noah become a drunkard? He died a drunkard, you know. Well, it wasn't before the flood. You see, before the flood, Noah was a preacher of righteousness. 100 years preaching righteousness to people who thought he was crazy, building an ark in the middle of a desert when there wasn't a cloud in the sky, telling everyone the world was going to be drowned. They thought he was crazy. It was after the momentous experience of the judgment of the flood. It was after his endurance and after his long suffering and after the patience of his faith preaching all these years and nobody listening to him. It was after this that he became a drunkard. After the mountaintop, valley. Here's another question for you. When was it that Moses spake unadvisedly with his lips? Well, it wasn't before the wilderness experience. You remember the story? God had said to Moses, "The nation is dying of thirst. I want you to go to the rock and speak to the rock and living water will come out." But you see, Moses let his temper get the better of him. And he became angry with God's people. And he began to revile the heritage of God, God's people. And he started to malign the Hebrews. And he said, "Look, God, what am I going to do with this lot? They won't listen, they won't obey, they won't follow. They are your people. Not my people, they are your people. And they're unteachable." You know the story, surely. He got so angry, he couldn't speak to the rock. And he smote the rock in his rage. And the water came out, but for maligning God's people and for striking the rock, Moses saw the promised land, but he never entered it. Now, when was it that Moses spake inadvisedly with his lips? Well, it was not before the mountaintop experiences in the wilderness. It was after them. After the special experience, the disaster. It was the same with Elijah. You know the story of how Elijah had carried the day for God on Mount Carmel and had won that tremendous victory over the prophets of Baal under Elijah. And immediately after this, a mood of black depression came on him. The psychiatrists would have said he was manic depressive. See, up on Mount Carmel, he was elated because God had triumphed. And then he fled for his life. What a journey that must have been, if you know the geography. Mount Carmel, right through the valley of Sharon, down past Shechem, Samaria, down past Bethel, Jerusalem, down past Bethlehem, down past Hebron, Sodom and Gomorrah, right down through the Sinai Peninsula that the Jews and the Arabs are disputing today, right down to Mount Sinai, and he crawled into a hole in the mountain and asked to die. After the mountaintop, there comes the valley. That's why on the mountaintops, you need to preserve yourself and guard your integrity. It was the same with Jesus. When was Jesus led out into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil? It was after his baptism. After that exalted experience in the River Jordan, the mountaintop, out into the wilderness to be tempted by Satan. Young Christians, one of the things you must learn to do as a Christian as you grow older and older is to learn to guard your integrity when you're having an ecstasy of Christ. You'll have ecstasies. Surely there's something wrong with your religion if you don't have ecstasy and enjoy Christ and his grace and his goodness, if you're not carried up into heaven with God's love for you. Something wrong with your religion if you don't have that. You can't live there all the time. If you try to live there all the time, you'll be very sick indeed. Very, very sick indeed. Learn to guard yourself. Don't you think the devil is as interested in ecstatic experiences as you are? Don't you think he can come in and ruin it and spoil it all? Don't you? Lesson one. On the mountaintop, guard yourself. Lesson two. Between chapter 12 and chapter 20, between Egypt and Gerar, in fact, 20 years have elapsed. And this teaches me a most essential lesson for the Christian life, and it's this. One of the wisest things any Christian can do is to cultivate a healthy respect for old temptations that you think you've mastered and are dead. Abraham thought this sort of thing was dead for 20 years, and it was still alive in his heart. You can wrestle with personal failings and private sins for many years and think you've got the better of them. And just when you least expect it, the devil will poke in his long finger and stir it all up again and drive you to despair. You see, one of the most awesome things about sin in the Bible is its resurrection power. You think it's dead, and it springs to life again. This is one of the things that's hinted at, you see, in the book of Revelation, where John sees a beast coming out of the sea with many heads and many crowns and diadems of blasphemy. And it seems as if one of the heads has been chopped off. But it grows again, and the beast still lives. He's dead, but he won't lie down. And sin is like this in a Christian life. There's a great phrase in Paul's letter to the Romans. He says, "Sin revived and slew me." Sin revived and slew me. Sin sprang to life again just when he thought he had slain it. Let me give you a topical illustration of this. I notice that the Chinese are boasting that they've managed to breed more pandas in captivity than any other nation in the world. Well, you think a panda is a cuddly creature, don't you? And pandas certainly look very cuddly with their two lovely black eyes. But what would you do if somebody gave you a panda for Christmas? I mean, a real panda. I could guarantee you wouldn't give it a cuddle, would you? You would put it in a cage, because a real panda would kill you. You see, a panda is just a pretty bear. And it's like that with all temptations. You've got to keep them under lock and key in a cage. Things you think you've mastered years ago. Because although they look harmless and innocent and pretty, they're just like the pandas. You see, all temptations are pretty bears in disguise, and if you embrace them, they will destroy you. Oh, young Christians, why do I harp on it, young Christians? Because I think these lessons need to be learned very early on in a Christian's life. Learn to cultivate a healthy respect for all temptations, and learn to keep old Adam where he needs to be kept, because if you don't, sin will revive. Sin can rise from the dead again and hurt you. The third great lesson from this episode is this, and it's a lesson that rebukes our Christian exclusivism. You know, I suppose that evangelicals, more than any others, are always tempted to put up the shutters and pull down the blinds and tuck in the blankets and say, well, we are the people, and outside us there is no righteousness. Well, God has his people in some very queer places. You notice why Abraham had told the lie. He said in verse 10, and Abimelech said to Abraham, "What were you thinking of that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place." What a nerve. There was more fear of God in Abimelech than there was in Abraham. Because there was faith in Abimelech, and we would have dismissed him as a pagan. We would have said, "That man's not Christian. He's not one of us. He's outside, you see. He's outside our blinds and our shutters and our tucked-in blankets." But there was more faith and more righteousness in that heathen king than there was in the man of God. Look at the story again. Look at these marvelous words from a heathen. Genesis chapter 20, verse 4. Now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, "Lord, wilt thou slay an innocent people?" He knew God was just. "Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister, it's not my fault'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." What words from a pagan! Then God said to him in the dream, and you'll notice that this pagan is not embarrassed speaking to God. "Yes, I know that you've done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore I did not let you touch her. Now then, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all that are yours." Verse 9. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, and here is a pagan speaking to a man of God, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." Fancy a heathen man saying that to a man who professed to be godly. Abimelech said to Abraham, "What were you thinking of that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place." And there was more fear of God in that place than there was in Abraham's heart. You see, God has his children in the queerest places. Jesus said, "Other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also must I bring." Can you take in these words fundamentally? Other sheep I have. They've never heard of Christ. They've never heard the gospel. But they were born to be the sheep of Christ. And Jesus calls them sheep. He doesn't call them goats. They're sheep. They belong to him. And when they hear his voice, they will respond, because they are destined to be the sheep of Christ. But they're still his sheep. And some of them live in very queer places. I think I've told you of the lady who once came to Mr. Still at the end of an evening service, a number of years ago. And she said how moved she had been with the message and how she'd loved to hear the word expounded and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere. And he said to her, "Where are you working?" And she said, "I'm an actress in the Tivoli." Now, the Tivoli was the old burlesque theatre, if you know Aberdeen. It's where they did all the lighter shows. And there is, you know, an actors and an actresses Christian union that meets regularly in London for Bible study and prayer and Christian encouragement. "Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring." Peter said, "In every nation, he who fears God and works righteousness is accepted by him." Isn't that thrilling? You see, there are Christians beyond the blinds and the shutters and beyond our tucked-in blankets. In every nation, he who fears God and works righteousness is accepted by him. I was looking up this afternoon just how often a particular phrase occurs in the Bible. Listen, Romans 2. "There is no respect of persons with God." Ephesians 6. "Neither is there respect of persons with him." 1 Peter 1. "God judges men without respect of persons." I think that's translated in the Phillips translation, "God has no favorites." And he doesn't, because he has his disciples in the queerest places. Do you remember how the disciples came to Jesus and complained that there was another fellow going around who wasn't one of them, apparently, and he was preaching in Christ's name and performing miracles in Christ's name? And the disciples said, "Get him to stop it. He's not one of us." And Jesus said, "You leave him alone. People do not take my name on their lips lightly. He that is not against us is for us." Think of how kind Christ was to the centurions. You know, Jesus never said an unkind thing about a Roman centurion. They were all heathens. Romans, gods, you know, the multiplicity of gods. He never said an unkind thing. And it was a Roman centurion who said, "Truly, truly, this was the Son of God." Oh, God has his children in queer places, and this makes the Christian life the most exciting life under the sun, because you never know when a Christian is going to turn up. Someone who had been to Russia this past year said how surprised she was and how delighted she was to discover that the guide taking her round the museum was a Christian. Now, they're all pretty well screened and vetted, the guides, you know. They've all got to wave the flag and all that sort of thing. But here's somebody who got through the screening. And as she told the tourists about the Russian icons and the saints and the miracles and all that sort of thing, it became immediately apparent that here was a believer in Jesus Christ in the most unexpected place. You know what your job is? To find out the Abimelechs in Inverness. There must be many. "Feed my sheep." It's one of the most exciting things in the world. to be this kind of Christian, going around looking for the sheep of Christ. This is what I do every day, every week of every year. I go around speaking to people, looking into their eyes, trying to find Christ, saying, now do you belong to him? You one of his? You on my side? You against me? Are you for him? Are you for the things I am for? This is what I do all the time. It's what I do at the door of the church. Why do you think I stand at the door of the church? Feed my sheep. I must say it. Not entertain the goats. Goats don't like what sheep like. Goats don't recognize the shepherd's voice. Goats are goats. You can never make goats into sheep. You can't do that. Sheep are sheep. And it's a thrill just to be able to go around and look into people's eyes and say, are you one of his? Abimelech? Are you one of the Abimelechs in Inverness? Absolutely wonderful. And surely you now see that it's your job to find them out, to seek them, and to feed them. Amen. May God bless the preaching of the word.